Hello, welcome to your meditation practice as part of the Open Heart Project. My name is Susan Piper, and I'm delighted that you signed up for the stages of the spiritual path. There are three in this particular view, and today we talk about the third. If you're interested in going back and listening or re-listening to the first two videos, you're more than welcome to, but you do not have to. I'll give a short recap here, and then we'll practice together for 10 minutes. So, it is said in Buddhism, which nobody has to be a Buddhist to take advantage of this intel, the Buddha gave three main cycles of teachings, and they're called three vehicles or yanas. And the first cycle of teachings, called the Hinayana or foundational vehicle, put forth the things that you or I or anyone would need to know to just get on the path, to just get started. Without these particular qualities that are focused on in the Hinayana teachings, we're going to be spinning our wheels. And these qualities include things like simplicity. If we make it overcomplicated, then we're just making bleep up. Discipline, which doesn't mean being perfect or beating yourself up or making yourself do things. It means you have the capacity and the intention to come back to what is important to you. That is what is meant by discipline. And renunciation, which doesn't mean giving up everything that's fun and only doing things that are not fun. It means giving up what is not essential. So the Hinayana teachings are about how do you do that? Obviously essential. Without this, we have no foundation. And whatever we may do without these qualities is BS, let's say. That may be too broad, but nonetheless. The second cycle of teachings, the Mahayana or greater vehicle, are not about greater practices or greater teachings in the sense of better, but greater in the sense that now your practice, because you have a strong foundation, basically, your practice enables you to enter the greater world with in a different way. In a more loving way, a more compassionate way, not a more wussy way, but a more sharply kind way, let's say. And so the Mahayana teachings are on love and compassion and emptiness and being of benefit. You can't be a benefit to others until you sort of stabilized your own situation. So that progression is organic and makes sense. Now, today, our topic is the third cycle, the Vajrayana teachings, Vajrayana, V-A-J-R-A, which is translated variously as adamantine, which means diamond-like, or indestructible, the indestructible vehicle, the diamond-like vehicle. And the Vajrayana teachings include the Hinayana and Mahayana. All the cycles are inseparable. They are not linear, like first you do this, then you do that, then you do this third thing. They are interwoven and inextricable, one from the other. So in other words, the point I'm trying to make here is not beginning, middle, and advanced. They're all beginning, middle, and advanced, and they just offer a different way of entering the journey. And different teachings speak to different people. So luckily we have three vast sets of teachings. So while the Hinayana and the Mahayana are relatively straightforward in terms of explaining what they cover, the Vajrayana, not so straightforward. This is all from the point of view of my training, by the way. So if you ask someone who is trained in a different way, they might give you different responses to these questions, but all my training has been within the Vajrayana. Those are the teachings that I've been studying and practicing for a bazillion years now, over 25 years. So again, I just take it with a grain of salt. It is thought that the Hinayana and Mahayana teachings are the exoteric teachings of Buddhism. And the Vajrayana teachings are the esoteric teachings or the mystical teachings. So every great religion or wisdom tradition in the world has both exoteric and esoteric dimensions. So, for example, in Judaism, countless exoteric teachings and practices and prayers. The esoteric aspect of Judaism is the Kabbalah. So it's the mystical realm. In the Vajrayana, now we enter the mystical realm. You may really like that, you may really not, but here we are together. So I'm grateful for that personally. The Vajrayana teachings, in my experience, are the opposite of anything New Agey and are so wildly down to earth that it can be impossible to believe and shocking. And what I mean by that is, in many mystical traditions and otherwise, the object, as it were, should there be an object, is to transcend ordinary life and go somewhere better, either now or after you die. I hope we'll all go somewhere better now and after we die. But the Vajrayana teachings are not about going anywhere, though they are profoundly mystical, and we may associate mysticism with going somewhere else. The mystical aspect here is embedded, cradled, cushioned in the ordinary, in everyday life, just as it is. In the Vajrayana, that is seen as your practice, everyday life. Your house, your clothes, the way you pay your bills, or not. The friendships you have, the love affairs you have, the conversations you engage in, the things that go extremely well for you and the rewards you receive in this life, and the things that go extremely unwell for you and the dings you receive from this life or worse, all of that is considered sacred. This is not better than that. Although certainly things that feel good feel better than things that feel bad. Nonetheless, this world, I'm looking around my house right now where I am making this video, and everything in it is considered your practice, as mentioned, and therefore is sacred. It's sacred not because it transports you somewhere else or there's some secret buried in everyday life, but simply because it is. No one can explain that, certainly not me. Nonetheless, that's the realm we're in the Vajrayana teachings and practices. As with all mystical or esoteric traditions, it is wildly important, or wicked important, as we'd say here in Boston, to have a teacher or a guide, because it's so confusing to enter this realm of unconventional wisdom with your conventional mind as your guide. So this is a very complicated area. And I'm not saying you need a guru or you should find a guru. I'm certainly not saying that I am any such guide, because I am not. But because, caution is advised. Caution is advised. Whether you're studying the Vajrayana teachings or the Kabbalah or Sufism or any of the mystical traditions of this world, when we enter them with a sense of what the brilliant and controversial Chögyam Trungpa called spiritual materialism, meaning what can I get from this? You're going to punch a one-way ticket to Palookaville, because it doesn't work that way. One needs a guide. That guide can be a living person, a post-living person. Anyway, to cover that topic is beyond the scope of this particular video, but I do want to say that a guide is needed, and friendship with fellow practitioners is of the utmost importance, because we can really confuse ourselves with the mystical traditions. Speaking from personal experience here. So within the Vajrayana, the view of sacred world is presented and practiced and contemplated and studied. It's not so simple, because at least speaking for myself, I'm like, okay, the world is sacred. I'm like, okay, now I should be happy because I'm in a sacred place. But a sacred place includes happy, but it also includes rage and disappointment and satisfaction and everything. Everything that we know is included in being human. It's interesting to me, making this video, giving this particular talk, I keep running into little brick walls in my mind. Where do I go with this? Which is entirely appropriate, because the Vajrayana is inscrutable. You can certainly study it, and you can learn about it, and you can read the texts, but it will not come alive without some understanding of how to go beyond. So I'm actually pleased that I'm finding it difficult to say these things, because that is consonant with the inscrutable nature of the teachings. That said, if you want a place to start in contemplating or studying or becoming more familiar with the realm of the Vajrayana, I suggest Googling the five Buddha families, or five Buddha wisdoms, as they're sometimes called. And these are teachings on the five ways sacred world arises, the five obstacles that we face, and the five forms that vast and profound wisdom take within you and around you. So for each of us, one of these five wisdoms is predominant. And then a second one is secondary, and so on. We all possess all five. But I'll just give you a very brief overview of what the five are. The five families are Buddha — that's not the historic Buddha, but referring to a form of wisdom, Buddha wisdom — Vajra, which means indestructible, as you now know, Ratna, Padma, and Karma. Buddha, Vajra, Ratna, Padma, Karma. Each of the wisdoms is associated with a color: white, blue, yellow, red, green, and a form of wisdom. Again, you possess all five, but for each of us, one of them is predominant. The wisdom of the Buddha family is called all-accommodating wisdom. It's the kind of wisdom that is so spacious and so without corners or edges that it can accommodate everything, can see everything. Vajra family, they're called families, wisdom is called mirror-like wisdom. It's the kind of wisdom that reflects back to you very clearly the truth of what is happening. Sharp, uncompromising. Ratna family wisdom is called the wisdom of equality. Not just saying, I want this and I don't want that, but sort of seeing everything as having some meaning or value, and not being greedy about holding on to what you want and rejecting all the things you don't want. These are very broad explanations, by the way. The wisdom of the Padma family, P-A-D-M-A, is called the wisdom of discernment, being able to really finely discern between this and that, to be able to detect the qualities inherent in a situation, a person, a color, attuned, super attuned. This is my family, by the way. I'm not saying I'm super attuned, but this is my predominant wisdom, as it were. But it also brings with it a predominant neurosis. The predominant neurosis of the Padma family is grasping. Of the Buddha family is spaciness. Of the Vajra family is anger. I know I'm going out of order. Of the Ratna family is greed. So it's a coin with two sides. And finally, the Karma family — I'm pointing over here because it's in the image I'm seeing in my mind. It's over here. is associated with the ability to accomplish what you set out to do. So the wisdom of the karma family is called all accomplishing wisdom. And the neurosis is speed, never ceasing to try to accomplish. So anyway, this is something interesting to explore if you think it's interesting. So you could Google five Buddha families, five Buddha wisdoms, and read further if you like. And we have a book by the fabulous Kevin Townley writing about becoming familiar with the five Buddha families through modern art. It's super cool. So anyway, just to summarize, the Hinayana teachings set us out on the path and create a foundation through simplicity, discipline, and renunciation, whereupon our hearts open to others in a less needy way. And we find ourselves in the world of the Mahayana, where the teachings focus on love in both its forms, relative, which relative love is what we think, being kind and connecting and caring, and absolute. Absolute love is considered synonymous with recognizing the empty nature of all phenomena. Don't ask me to explain that because I can't. And then when we have this foundation and some relationship and capability in the realm of love, suddenly we're able to see the world as sacred. And the practice in the Vajrayana is to meet everything that you encounter as the possible moment of complete enlightenment. So in the Hinayana and somewhat in the Mahayana, we want to get away a little bit from daily concerns and devote ourselves to what we consider sacred or important. Those are really great things to do. In the Vajrayana, it's the opposite. We don't try to get away from anything. We try to go towards everything. And that becomes our practice. So I hope this has been interesting and useful, more important than interesting. And if you want a community to study and practice with, to study all these things and to practice all these things, please consider joining the Open Heart Project Sangha. It was built to provide a way to do just that, practice and study together. So let's sit. We begin our practice by establishing a posture. And the basic idea is to sit up straight, whether you're seated on the floor with your legs crossed loosely in front of you, or in a chair or on the couch. And if possible, have your feet flat on the floor, but not if that's painful. So sit in a way that is not painful and that enables you to sit up straight. Because just taking the seat of meditation is a proclamation of our dignity and wholeness. And so we can feel that more readily with an upright posture. The hands rest on the legs, palms down. And let the front body soften a lot. The belly, the area around the heart, and the throat. Three gates: gate of intuition, the gate of emotion, the gate of speech. They're always open, it seems. And that's okay, because we have this very strong back to support it all. Something to think about. Let your shoulders relax. Nothing to carry or hoist. The chin is tucked a little bit, so the neck is long. The mouth is closed. And the lips and teeth are slightly parted. And let all the infrastructure of speech relax. The jaw, the tongue, the throat, the inclination to speak. You can let go of those things right now. You don't need them. I find that quite delightful. The breath is natural in and out through the nose, meaning no breathing technique, just breathing, which you're already really pretty good at. The eyes are open in this practice, and the gaze is cast down to a spot in front, someplace comfortable, up to 6 feet or 2.5 meters or less, given where your screen is. And let your eyes just come to rest on a spot with a sense of receptivity as opposed to seeking. You're receiving. And we practice with the eyes open for, among other reasons, it helps us to be awake, and we're practicing being awake. So it's easier to be awake when your eyes are open. And the crown of the head reaches up a little bit. Now let your attention come to rest on the breath, which does not mean observe the breath, interestingly. It means feel the breath. There's a subtle difference between observing and feeling, or not so subtle sometimes. Can you find that difference? Feeling means you just feel. Feel the body expand on the inhale and let go on the exhale. And stay with the sensation of breath as best you can. Ride the inhale all the way in. See if you can spot the moment it becomes an exhale, but don't try too hard because it's impossible. And then ride the exhale all the way out into the space in front where there's a little gap, a rest. And then the next inhale just happens. I promise. The amount of effort required from you is zero. So just stay with the natural flow of breath in and out. Your mind, of course, will continue to make thoughts. That's what it does. It's not a problem. There's no effort to stop that or change that or anything that. Just let your thoughts come and go, like birds in the sky, most of which will not distract you overly from your breath, maybe for a millisecond. That's fine. However, if you notice that you've flown off into the sky with the birds, meaning you've become so absorbed in a line of thought that you have forgotten about your breath completely, very good. You just woke up and saw where your mind was. And because of that, you have choices. And the choice here is to notice that. Label that moment silently thinking. Let go. Doesn't matter what the content is. Just let go. Gently come back to this breath and begin again, feeling the body breathe. So we'll sit together in silence for a little while until you hear the gong. Thank you so much for your practice. Thank you for practicing with me. I feel it. And thank you for practicing together.